Joining us on the weekend today is Dr. Diana Natalicio. Dr. Natalicio is stepping down. Dr. Natalicio was born as Diana Seethoff to Bill and Joe Seethoff in 1939, and we're going to carry on from there and talk a little bit about her growing up and how she came to UTEP and became our president. Dr. Natalicio, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
So I talked a little bit about you being born in 1939 in St. Louis to Joe and Bill. Tell us a little bit about your parents.
Well, my parents were very important in shaping my life, my brothers and my life. My father lived through the Depression, and so he had a very special view on just how difficult life could be. And he was very frugal, and he taught me a lot about how to save money and how to be responsible in terms of money. My mother and my father had a small dairy business that we operated for many years, and that business eventually was overtaken by technology. The industry changed. There was a disruption of first paper bottles, then plastic bottles, and the glass bottles that used to be left on the back porches of women who stayed at home all day were no longer very viable because women were not at home all day. They were working. And so as a result of that, the business ultimately was sold to a larger company, and my father completed that very successfully. He was very smart and very successful, but he only had 2 years of high school. My mother, on the other hand, finished high school, wanted to go to college, and her father told her no, that he wouldn't support that because she had a younger brother who he felt was better qualified as a male to go to college. And so he sent my mother's younger brother to college. And my mother never really forgave him for that. I think she so wanted to get more education. But she was self-educated, and so she did a lot of things, very interesting things in her life, including dancing in a vaudeville troupe with a chorus group. Of what they did were kind of ethnic dances in between the acts of the man with the monkey and the accordion player and the ballet and the soprano and all of that. So she also became active in the League of Women Voters. She was very much involved in women's rights. And I learned a great deal from her, too. So they were great parents, but neither one of them had the university education.
As far as the business itself, so I imagine that you and your brother helped run because it was a family business?
Absolutely. We were involved very much in it. My brother worked in the dairy proper. I ran the kind of retail outlet at the front of the dairy, especially during the summer. I spent all day there every day working at the cash register and dispensing milk and cottage cheese and butter and all the things that we made at the dairy. In those days, dairies were very, very different, obviously, from now. And so it was a small operation, kind of like Farmer's Dairy here in El Paso, and probably smaller than that. But we learned a lot from participating. We both worked hard in the business, and I think that also has set a kind of trajectory for our lives. Both of us have had long and successful careers and always worked very, very hard and enjoyed what we did.
Did your father and mother push you also to do reading and writing when you were younger?
My mom especially. My father was so busy with the business that he had precious little time to spend. He would be home on a Sunday, but that was the only day of the week that he would be home, and he had home maintenance issues to do and so on. We helped him with that, with the garden. But my mother was extremely interested in providing us with a well-rounded education. And so she did indeed help us learn the joy of reading. I had an aunt who was kind of a teacher aide, and she taught me to read when I was three. And so I remember going to the St. Louis Public Library and seeing all the books in this beautiful old Carnegie Library and thinking and telling my aunt that I was going to read them all. And so that was I began reading at an early age. My mother read with me all the time. And on Saturdays, for example, my mother would sit us down in front of the radio, and we would listen to the Metropolitan Opera as a radio broadcast. She had a book, Victor's Book of the Opera, and so she would read to us about the storyline and what was going on, and the libretto, and then we would listen to the music, and at intermission she would talk to us about it. So she was in many ways a great teacher. She took us to the art museum. She took us to other museums, and St. Louis is blessed still with wonderful museums, and so we learned a lot from museums, and to this day I like museums because of that.
It's no secret that you are a big baseball fan, and as you just mentioned, listening to the radio and living in St. Louis, at what point did you get interested in baseball, and perhaps were you a tomboy, you and your brother?
Well, I would say both. Actually, in terms of being a Cardinals fan, we became Cardinals fans very early because everyone in our neighborhood was a Cardinals fan. There was another team called the St. Louis Browns, but nobody dared be one of those, so we were all Cardinals fans, and at the time, Harry Carey was the announcer on the radio of St. Louis Cardinals games, and he was terrific because he not only called the game very well, but he would do a lot of explanation about the strategy and about things like that. And so we learned from him. We learned how to keep score. We kept score. We had little books where you could put the scores in, and we would listen on the radio and keep score. And there's a wonderful story about that Doris Kearns Goodwin tells about the book that she wrote about the Brooklyn Dodgers leaving Brooklyn and going to L.A. And she talks about her childhood and her dad and baseball fandom. And she said that as a great historian that she's become, one of the ways that she learned how to do narrative was to keep the baseball scores on paper at home until her father came home from his job, because all the games were played in daytime, so people who were working couldn't watch the games or listen to them. But she would then, through the scorecard, repeat the entire narrative of the game. And she learned then how to tell the story of a baseball game by using her scorecard as her guide. And I've always thought about that, because learning to keep score really does help you understand the game better. And so we loved St. Louis Cardinals and cheered for them all the time. We used to hide from my parents at night with a little portable radio when the Cardinals were playing a night game someplace, and we would listen until we fell asleep. We weren't supposed to be listening, but we managed to purloin a small portable radio that we would listen to. So we were very much fans. We played a lot of baseball, too, and I certainly played a great deal. I love still to throw a baseball. Not real good for my shoulder, but I love to throw a baseball. Because we didn't have television, we didn't have technology, we didn't have a lot of the things that kids today are absorbed in. We spent almost all of our time outside playing ball, riding bicycles, roller skating, doing 1,000 things outside. And so as a result, we played baseball. And it was sandlot. It was baseball that we enjoyed and played. And I always fashioned myself to be Stan Musial, who was a St. Louis Cardinals hero. And I would put 6 on the back of my T-shirts because that was his number. And my brother wanted to be Red Chaney, who was a shortstop on the St. Louis team, and I think that was because he had red hair, and my brother had somewhat reddish hair, and so my brother wanted to be him. And so we were into the game, both playing it and being fans, and becoming quite knowledgeable about it. I mean, I loved watching Ken Burns' series on baseball because it just so brought back so many wonderful memories of how baseball used to be the king of all sports, right?
You mentioned Ken Burns, and there was another documentary that was very big for him, in addition to the Civil War in baseball, but he did one on World War II. And you were still very young when war broke out, but do you remember anything about those times?
I remember very little about it. I do remember that our family in the 1890s came to the United States from Germany to flee the Prussian army. My grandfather, to avoid having to serve in the Prussian army. And so as a result of that, they left some family members in Germany, some aunts and others of mine, or my mother's, rather, and contemporaries of my mother. So they'd be my aunts, but they were in Germany. And so I remember at the end of the war, what I remember first is at the end of the war, my grandmother would make packages, put together packages with coffee and shoes and other things. And I would watch her packing these boxes and ask her, "Grandma, where are you going? Who's going to get this box? Or is it a gift?" And she would always say, "Your family in Germany." And so what she was doing at the end of the war was sending them things that they couldn't get. They all lived way out in the country. They were all farmers. And so they really weren't involved in the day-to-day war activity, but they lacked almost everything. And some 30 or 40 years later, there was a fellow who came to El Paso, a German, with the Air Force. And he was an economics PhD, and he would administer continuing ed tests at Fort Bliss for the German Air Force. They would take the courses, and then he would come and administer oral exams. And he came to visit me when I was Dean of Liberal Arts, and we chatted. And informally, I asked him where he'd been in the U.S., and he told me San Francisco, Grand Canyon. But he said, "Where I really want to go is St. Louis." Well, it turned out he's my cousin. And so I met him in the on the corner of the Centennial Museum. We were walking along the campus. And so subsequently, I went to Germany. I'd never been there before. And it was wonderful to go to the country where their farms are located and so on. So I kind of closed the loop on that. And that cousin actually told me a story about riding his bicycle a couple of miles or more to the bigger town in that whole rural area to pick up boxes from my grandmother. How's that? That's closing the loop perfectly, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, we've heard, we are familiar with what's going on currently, administration, government, a lot of discrimination going on. Did you experience any of that during World War II or after being of German descent?
None at all. I don't remember anything about that. We lived in a neighborhood where there were a lot of Eastern Europeans and Germans, and mostly Germans, Eastern Europeans, Czech, just a variety of countries in that area, Hungarians. And so, we just really didn't get very – I didn't have any sense. Everybody was kind of an immigrant. And so nobody really, I don't recall anything. There may have been, but I don't remember it.
We're having a conversation with Dr. Diana Natalicio, president here at the University of Texas at El Paso. We talked a little bit about education and your mom's desire for you all to do the best that you could. You went on to a high school in St. Louis, but in some of the remarks that I've read of other interviews you've done, you claim or say that it didn't really prepare you for college, your high school education, and that you were weak in math and in literature. It's hard to imagine you would be weak at anything.
Oh, you're sweet to say that. But actually, the high school I attended was very, very inadequate. And that's sad because the neighborhood we lived in was a modest neighborhood, but the elementary school was very good. All the teachers were women. They were more mature, many of them single women, and they were totally dedicated to immigrant kids and all of us in the neighborhood. And so as a result of that, we got a very solid elementary education. When we went on to high school, we went to a regional high school, had to ride the bus to get there, and that high school was committed to vocational education, sending graduates into the workforce. We were all blue-collar kids, and they basically had one agenda, which was to prepare us to join the workforce. So the boys took machine shop and woodworking, things like that. The girls took secretarial studies in home economics. And the idea was, in St. Louis in those days, the best jobs were union apprenticeships, electricians, plumbers, carpenters, and all of that. And the boys would become then apprentices in the unions when they graduated from this high school. And they did very, very well. I have friends still in St. Louis whose husbands became apprentices in the unions and went on to careers with Anheuser-Busch or McDonnell Aircraft or some of the other big companies. And they retired years ago and had great pensions and always benefits, you know, health benefits. They did very, very well. That generation was very fortunate after World War II. So I think, you know, the high school was serving a real purpose at the time, which was to provide workers for the post-war effort and so on. But when I got to that high school, I really realized that it was not the caliber of my elementary school. But I had a good time, and, you know, I mean, I knew that I wasn't working very hard academically, but there was no reason to because there was no one there to push us. And I became very good at shorthand and very good at typing, and I'm still really fast on the keyboard. So, you know, those skills are obviously lifelong. But it was disappointing because I then realized when I took a job, I went to work directly out of high school, just like everybody else in my class. We all went to work. And I became a receptionist and a switchboard operator. And I've told this story many times that I was, you know, kind of the Lily Tomlin of Nordberg Manufacturing. And after a month, frankly, I was 17. I was afraid because I realized this was not a job that I could do for very long without becoming a madwoman of some kind. And I knew, I felt as though the switchboard was just pulling me in. My future was just going into that switchboard, and I had to do something about it. So I was fortunate that St. Louis University was accessible by bus, and I went to St. Louis University, a private school. There were no public universities in St. Louis at that time. And I asked them whether they would let me enroll and that I would work really hard, and I promised them I'd be a good student. But I was scared because I knew I couldn't compete, or I thought I couldn't compete with the boys that came out of the prep school. It's a Jesuit school, and the Jesuit prep school certainly prepared them better than I was prepared. But it turned out fine because I am a hard worker and because I think most of them bragged about things that they really didn't know. And so the competition became a little bit more normalized. And St. Louis University did for me what should happen with higher education, which is higher education ought to open the doors to a much better life. And it was a life that, well, was like charmed. I mean, I went off on a Fulbright to Brazil, and I went to Portugal and lived there. And I mean, the 1960s were just a great time to go to college because there was so much federal money and everybody wanted to get the population better educated after the various wars that we fought. And it was very exciting, very, very exciting to go to college, to get that kind of support. And then during the entire decade of the 60s, I was in either traveling abroad or living abroad, or I was in Austin doing a master's degree and a doctorate. And by the end of the 60s, I was ready to go and came here to UTEP.
It must have been a little bit difficult for you to travel outside of the country by yourself.
Well, it was the first trip. After that, it was not hard at all. I was quite adventuresome. But my first trip to Brazil was pretty daunting because I'd never been on an airplane, never been away from home. And I got the Fulbright fellowship to Brazil. And I was shocked because I didn't think when I applied for it that I'd really get it. I applied for it more out of a sense of duty to St. Louis University and thanks for what they had done for me. Because they were using this as a means of proving their quality to get a Phi Beta Kappa chapter. So I, at first, didn't think I could possibly get on an airplane and go to Brazil. But after 3 or 4 days of carrying this letter from my congressman around to ponder, I finally realized I've got to do this. I must do this. And so I packed up everything I thought Brazil didn't have, And I went off to Washington, D.C. on my first plane ride, and then on to Caracas and then Rio de Janeiro, because you couldn't fly directly in those days. And it was the greatest year of my life in many ways, because it opened up so many doors for me and taught me about myself and my resilience and my ability to live in different settings and to cope with unexpected developments and all of that. So it was a wonderful growth year for me.
In 1971, you came to El Paso and you started out as an assistant professor, and then you became the chair of linguistics. And then, of course, after 17 years, I believe it was, in 1988, you were appointed president of the university. When you first came here to UTEP, did you have any plans to perhaps just stay a few years and then move on to another university?
Well, in fact, I had plans to stay 1 year because I was then married, and my then husband and I were looking for two faculty positions. And the one that I got at UTEP was a temporary 1 year appointment. And so we came with the expectation that we would continue to search for two tenure track jobs and go wherever that might be. But shortly after arriving here, we both began to understand why this was such a great place to live. And I'd lived in a lot of different settings by then, and I realized El Paso was just very special. I mean, the climate, the proximity to Juarez, the ability to live in two countries at the same time, the mountains, everything about El Paso I just found quite appealing. And especially the people. The people were so friendly and so kind. My students were wonderful. They were just great to work with. And so after 2.5 or 3 months, we looked at each other and said, there's no need to go anyplace else. We'll work this out. And as it turned out, it worked.
You were a chair and a professor of linguistics. Did you have the opportunity to learn any foreign language as you were growing up?
As I was growing up, no. I didn't learn anything then. And that may have had something to do with the war. I'm not sure, because German would have been the likely language, though my parents never spoke German, really, at all. They were their parents were immigrants. My grandparents were immigrants. But by that generation, my mom and dad really didn't speak German. They understood a few words and so on, but they didn't really speak. They were Americans, and they wanted to speak English. And my mother was enormously articulate. She was really a very, very articulate woman, very knowledgeable, well-read. And so I didn't learn any languages until I went to college. Well, I took Spanish in high school, but at that high school, it wasn't very in-depth. But at college, I majored in Spanish because I liked Spanish a lot. There was something about the language. And that got me then sort of indirectly into Portuguese, which is pretty close, but not quite. And so after that, then other languages aren't so hard to acquire. And I'm hoping to refresh my Portuguese on a trip that I'm going to take fairly soon to Portugal, because I was meeting with a group of students from Mozambique the other day that are part of a program in the communication department here at UTEP, and there was a group from Colombia. So I was trying to speak English, Spanish, and Portuguese, and by the end of the time I met with them, I had no idea what I was saying.
We're visiting with Dr. Diana Natalicio, the president here at the University of Texas at El Paso. We talked earlier about your mother and your father and how they struggled as far as not struggling academic-wise, but struggling because they had to work. They had to make ends meet. Tell me a little bit about your mom when you were appointed president here at UTEP, and she must have been just overjoyed.
Yeah, well, I think she was overjoyed the minute I got the Fulbright, and she learned about it because I didn't tell her at first. I think she was overjoyed with that because she saw that as a huge step in a direction that she wanted. Actually, when I moved here in 1971, shortly thereafter, my father had a serious illness. And So the physician, my father's physician in St. Louis, told me and my brother that we had to get my dad out of that dairy, that he was struggling against all odds to make it work. And so he told me that they needed to move somewhere. The only place I could think of was El Paso, because that's where I was. So they moved here in 1972. And it was a great place for them to live. They loved living here. They were participating in a lot of my exploits as a faculty member and dean and so on. And both of them lived 30 years beyond. My dad was 72 when he came. My mom was 62. And they both lived another 30 years after they moved to El Paso. So I think the climate and the people and the pace of life here and not having that dreaded business to have to salvage just totally changed their lives, too. So that was great.
It's no secret that you are very well loved by all of us here in the community. And an example of that was when you were going to take a picture with everyone wearing one of these T-shirts. And one of the things that comes to mind also is you got to be a pretty good sport to be able to have a caricature of your bun on a T-shirt and everywhere and just flow with it.
Well, I am. I love humor, and I love whimsy. I think we all take ourselves far too seriously. And so I believe that if there is something that people want to do that is sweet and well-intentioned, no matter, I mean, at first this whole bun thing was just kind of a mystery to me, but then I began to realize the back of my head is my best angle, and so we might as well go with it. And it's been delightful. All the different spin-offs from this have been delightful. And I'm just very, very happy that the students enjoyed it. And, you know, it's been fun for all of us, I think, including me.
As far as the future, what can we expect from Dr. Natalicio? I don't foresee you being settled down. Slowing down much?
Well, I will slow down some because, frankly, the pace has been pretty relentless, and I'm looking forward to not getting up every morning and looking at the calendar to know exactly what I'm going to do every 15 minutes or half hour or hour. And so I'm looking very much forward to that. I will be involved. I've been invited to do some lecturing around the country at universities, and I've done a little bit of that recently and enjoy that, and I enjoy talking to people about social mobility and how important it is that public higher education be the vehicle for social mobility for students who wouldn't otherwise have a good life. And so I'm going to do some of that. I may do some writing, but I'm not ready right now to take that on. I'd love to write a tell-all book, but, you know, maybe not. And I want to travel, and I want to relax, listen to good music, read books, and travel. And there are a lot of places that I've been in the world, but surely there are some gaps.
At first, when you proposed the different ideas as far as admissions to UTEP, you came under heavy criticism and fire by some people saying that we were lowering our standards too much, but it's been very successful.
We haven't lowered our standards a bit. We've raised them. And all of that naysaying, some of which continues to this day, there are still people who believe you've got to be, in order to be an R1, a high top-tier research university, you must be highly selective in admissions and you must use the SAT and ACT as your filter. Well, we've studied that very closely. And what we've discovered is if we look at our graduates and trace back, then them to their SAT and ACT scores, there's no predictive value. It doesn't tell us anything about the likelihood of their success. Students who graduate from UTEP have low and high and medium SAT and ACT scores, and it doesn't matter. The question is, what is their real talent? These tests don't measure that. And now we're seeing all the problems that are coming up with ACT and SAT and all of the corruption and the so-called scandal. They're vulnerable because they haven't done things that have really leveled the playing field for low-income students. Even before the scandal, wealthy parents are able to hire tutors and coaches and take their kids to practice tests over and over until they're very accustomed to taking the test. Most people of modest means can't do that, and so the students walk in, take the test once, and they're done, and they have to live with that score. It's not right.
Well, on behalf of the entire community and everyone else here at UTEP, we want to say thank you very much for your service.
Well, I love what I do, and I'm so happy that I've been able to do it here.
Thank you, Dr. Natalicio.
You bet. Thank you.
Perspectives is taped in, I'm sorry, it's The Weeknd, right? The Weeknd is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Sam Cassiano. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to The Weeknd. I'm Louis Sines.